G'day there, my name is John Caruso. Welcome to another episode of Everyone Has a Story. This is the podcast that complements our two quarterly lifestyle magazines. In Noosa Magazine, the autumn 2022 issue is out on the streets right now, and the autumn issue of Hello Sunshine Magazine will hit the streets in a couple of weeks. If you would like your brand and your business to be part of these exciting and much-loved publications, then reach out to our client service managers. You can find us on Facebook and on Instagram, Hello Sunshine Magazine and In Noosa Magazine. Okay, on with today's episode. In today's episode, we're going to meet the founder and managing director of Respond Global, which is an organization where a team of superheroes operate out of an unassuming office in Noosaville. Now, this conversation was recorded before the Russian invasion of Ukraine and before the flooding that occurred along the Australian East Coast. Because of those two big headline events, COVID-related news hasn't been as prominent as it was when this episode was recorded. However, according to medical and scientific experts, new variants of COVID will inevitably develop, and we'll have to learn to continue to manage and live with that. Everyone has a story, and today I'd like you to meet the remarkable Dr. Ian Norton. And I think this is important whenever we're talking about COVID and in the last couple of years, with so much, you know, fake news out there and people that are unqualified to talk about particular subjects. So to start with, Ian, to qualify and attribute the information that listeners will hear when they listen to this episode, can you tell me a little bit about your background, your studies, your training, your medical experience, and where you've come from and what your experience and training has been all about?
Sure. Thanks, John. So I started as an emergency physician. It's a fairly long road to become a specialist in emergency medicine. You have to be a jack of all trades, if you like, and able to handle the emergency room, all comers, adults, children, people coming with trauma, heart attacks, strokes, et cetera, right down to the smaller things. So my background was mostly in emergency medicine, but I was always drawn to mass casualties, trauma, disaster type discussions. And I started even back in the early days in Ireland, where I did my formative training in University College Dublin, and also my first 3 or 4 years of work in various specialties as you rotate through and get experience of a lot of things. I was always interested in the mass casualty and preparing for major incidents. When I came out to Australia, I moved right across the country, was working first of all in Newcastle, then through Nambour, when that was the main hospital here on the Sunshine Coast, for many years. And I worked on the helicopters and intensive care and anesthetics, as well as in the emergency department. Then up through Darwin for a short while, and then to Perth, where I did my final fellowship exams, and then back up to Darwin. So I did a lot of work up in Darwin. I was drawn really to Darwin because of the tropical medicine infectious disease. I had done some postgraduate qualifications in international health, developmental work, and epidemiology and management of infectious disease in poor income settings, as well as doing basic surgical training. But all of that, I then had to add on a fellowship in emergency medicine. But up in Darwin, it allowed me to become eventually the deputy director and then director of training for emergency medicine up in the top end, and then very much into mass casualty management. So I helped set up and become the chair of mass casualty management for Australia, the MIMS courses where we were teaching across the country and mass casualty. And then I suppose I helped set up Australia's first Australian medical response team up in Darwin. Back then it was, we weren't getting much funding. So I think we had a couple of $1,000, and I bought some fishing shirts on Kavanagh Street in Darwin because they were the coolest sort of uniform we could find, as in lightest and lightest weight. And now they are the national uniform for Australia's medical response teams when they go overseas. Started as a few backpacks and gradually put more and more money together. And eventually we end up with a 35-ton field hospital that Australia can proudly send around the region to support others.
Prior to COVID, and we'll talk about COVID in a minute, Ian, what other large-scale emergencies have you and your team attended?
Yeah, so in Australia, I was the lead of the Australian Medical Response Team for about 6 years or so. I led the response to one of the big refugee boat explosions, probably the first big one you saw at Ashmore Reef, mostly to deal with mass casualty burns. And then I was the leader of the medical team going into the Pakistan floods from the civilian side. There was a joint military and civilian operation into the Pakistan floods back in 2010, 11. And then 2013, I led the team into Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines, which was a great experience. And we did a lot of good work there, and also into the dengue outbreaks in the Solomon Islands in the same year. From then on, I was sent to WHO, actually, as a secondment from the Australian government in 2014. I went there for the first 2 years was as a government secondee to try and help the WHO set up a program to develop national medical response teams, just like we have and we had started here in Australia. I was asked to sort of do that for the rest of the world. And that then grew into a large program, and I stayed on for a further 4 years. So a total of 6 years, helping countries across the world develop their own medical response teams, probably about 130 countries. And in that time, I was the lead of the Ebola response in West Africa from a clinical care point of view. I was the one sent in to manage the creation of large treatment centers in three countries, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. And I spent about 5 out of the 7 months of the worst time during that West African Ebola. Then on to Nepal in 2015. I was on the ground within about 72 hours, no, 36 hours rather, to help coordinate about 150 teams coming from around the world to support Nepal during its earthquake, and stayed there for about 6 weeks during the early response and recovery. Into Mosul City in northern Iraq, had to set up the trauma system for the Iraq response, because we knew that was going to be the worst civilian affected conflict since World War II. But 1.5 million civilians caught up in that conflict with ISIS and the various militia around the outskirts of Mosul. So I was in the middle of very close to the front line, setting up medical response teams and things. So that was all the previous. And then into COVID, I was when I arrived back in to set up Respond Global here in the Sunshine Coast. The first sort of waves of COVID started to hit in January 2020, and so by March, April, I was on board the Ruby Princess to help get that crew safe and out of their outbreak and managed. That was a major, I suppose, first big response. And then after that, we helped with the aged care response down in Victoria in August, September of 2020. We were brought in by the federal government to help set up an emergency operations centre along with Emergency Management Australia. So it was to set up the control of how to manage 160 aged care facilities who are all infected at once. So that's been our major roles in COVID. And since then, a lot of work in rapid antigen testing, a lot of work with industry, with the meat sector, with lots of professional services. And throughout this time, also working with WHO to help support outbreaks across some of the poorer income countries in Southeast Asia particularly, and also in the Middle East.
And why did you set up Respond Global here on the Sunshine Coast as opposed to Canberra or Sydney or Melbourne or a larger hub like that?
Firstly, it's a family reason. Obviously, my wife is from the Sunshine Coast, and it would be great to be near, and it is great to be near her mother and father, and to allow our son to understand what it's like to grow up on the coast. He only knew Darwin for 3 or 4 years, and then Geneva. For 6 years. So it's been great to bring him back to Australia and have him grow up and understand all the fantastic lifestyle you can have on the Sunshine Coast and nippers, etc. And also because this is a global company that can actually be based pretty much anywhere. And why wouldn't you want to be based in somewhere beautiful like this? It's very strategic also because from the Pacific point of view, our first sort of work and what Respond Global is all about would be into and will be into the Pacific. And
Sure.
therefore, Brisbane is an ideal jump-off point, and to be able to live, just 60 or 90 minutes away from that major airport, and also the Sunshine Coast Airport allows us that access we need.
Did Respond Global have anything to do with the crisis in Tonga following the earthquake?
We were immediately asked about it, and we will probably have a response. We can get into that as we go through our discussion. But if all goes well with one of our new assets, particularly a vessel, then I think we'll be involved in probably some support there in about 3 or 4 months from now. So
Okay.
the initial phase seems to be well covered. We discussed a lot about what we might offer and talked to our various partners about it. And in the end, it looks like the needs were covered in the early phases, and therefore we're now looking at how we can go in about 3 to 4 months from now, when the mental health and primary care issues will start to really become a need, and also when a lot of the other early responders will have left and not all the work has been done.
Yeah, I worked for the ABC for about 6 years, and often after the headlines fade and the story's not making news on the 6 p.m. bulletin, that's when a lot of the recovery work really, you know, it's an ongoing exercise, isn't it? The recovery process after a natural disaster, like what's happened in Tonga.
Yeah, for sure. You're absolutely right. There is, it's not all about that, but certainly some of the early responses, a lot about the visibility and the real work begins, as you say, 4 or 6 weeks into it. And often it's just left to the national team. So that's really what we want to come in and support.
Well, COVID occupies a lot of the news headlines and the news space these days, Ian. So let's talk a little bit about that. With your experience and what you've seen in dealing with epidemics or pandemics overseas, the Ebola virus you mentioned, in regards to COVID, might there be, or do you envisage a time in the future when we'll rid the world of COVID and all associated variants?
That will be many years or even decades away. So I can't see that we'll ever be truly free of COVID-19, but it will become eventually a coronavirus like many other coronaviruses. There are about a third of all common colds are caused by a coronavirus, and they may well have been a pandemic back in their day as well. But gradually over time, they get so much more infectious and yet cause less and less disease that eventually we truly can just get along and live with them, because they don't become a big burden on society. But how long that will take, if that is really our future for COVID-19, that will be many, many years, if not decades. There are two other options, I suppose, with coronavirus. And now I'm quoting a good friend who's still working in Geneva in the headquarters of WHO. She describes that sort of, that's the best case option, that it could become that common cold, but it will take years and years to go that way. The other options are where probably the smart money is, that it will maintain as an epidemic, coming in big waves that go across the world, but won't necessarily affect the entire world all at once. And that's, I suppose, a start to live with it, because that means that the personal protective equipment and the tests and the treatments can move with the wave. It doesn't have to be everywhere all at once, and so our resources can be better managed. And the third option, and that's is the worst case scenario, which could put us back with a new variant that is completely novel, and we have to reinvent new vaccines, and no prior immunity comes from natural infection. There's probably still a 5 to 10% risk that could happen.
What did health authorities and governments learn about dealing with this particular pandemic when you look over the last 2.5 years? What errors were made and what might be done differently in the future?
That's a very broad question, but I suppose lessons identified, maybe rather than lessons learned. I still feel that sometimes we don't truly learn our lessons, that we can identify them. And I think, Australia particularly, let's focus on that. We didn't actually take on what was happening in other countries. We were a bit, there was probably a lack of hubris maybe for a while. Obviously, we had this incredible advantage of being an island and being able to shut our borders early and keep and prevent the virus coming here in large quantities early. So that luck was, gave us this opportunity. And did we really, really learn all the lessons we could have from other parts of the world while they were suffering huge outbreaks? I mean, we certainly, it allowed us to wait out the development of vaccine and roll out vaccine. Although we were slow at the beginning, we did an incredible job later. But I want to focus probably on one thing that's very close to our particular heart at the moment, which is rapid antigen testing. We were looking at this kind of testing from July, August of 2020. And as a person coming from outbreak management, so dengue, diphtheria in the Rohingya camps, all these other responses I've helped with, I just want to get every tool I can possibly get and put that in my toolbox just in case. And I took that approach when I went to see the health minister federally and lots of the chief health officers and the ministers for health in each of the states, and say, there is this other form of testing. It's called rapid antigen testing. It's being used in mass scale by the millions per day in countries like the UK, US, and across Europe. we really need to get ready to use this test, because when it happens here, when we finally get our waves and our outbreaks, it's a very, very valuable tool. It's not perfect, but it really is a useful test when you get to wide-scale outbreak response. So my background is only in those big, overwhelming disasters and outbreaks when they've blitzed all your other control mechanisms, and now you truly are facing a disaster. That's the skill set I have. And so going to them and talking to them like this, they took it almost as an affront to their preparedness. It was a very interesting conversation. They sort of said, well, we have such great controls in place, it will never happen here. And I went, I just don't agree. I think we have to. That's great. I truly hope that's the case, but let's at least get ready. Let's be prepared. So that was a big shock for me, actually, across Australia when I went state to state and to the federal government to talk about this. It was not a question of let's just get ready just in case. It was no, you're attacking my ability to manage this outbreak by telling me I have to get ready for when I lose control of it. No, that's not what we're saying, but let's get ready anyway. And then also, you know, the pathology companies having vested interest in pathology colleges and going out there debunking other forms of testing, lots and lots of discussion between private and public sector. It's been fascinating to watch the amount of money can be made by testing and that sort of defense of a form of testing so that certain companies can make money and things. It's been, I think a bit of a disappointment to me in a way, and that's a lesson personally for me looking at this and going, my goodness, we, not all people were thinking about it just purely from a let's get rid of the outbreak so we can get back to normal life. There was other factors at play. Of course, I knew that was the case, but I was disappointed that it was the case here, just as I found it in Africa and Asia and other places I've worked.
Yeah. What's your professional thought and opinion on what's happening now? To me, as a layperson in the street, there feels like there's a sense of complacency. We're seeing cases decrease. We're seeing less people with wearing masks. People don't have to check in when they go into businesses and retail, etc. Is there a sense of complacency, and should we be nervous? Is there something, again, you know, you spoke about being prepared. As a professional in the medical world, is there something we should be not anxious or concerned about, but prepared for, something around the corner? And is this sense of complacency okay?
I think at the moment it's okay, in that, yes, I agree we're getting complacent, but in a way we've been told and messaged by the public health departments, Queensland and other states, that it's actually okay to let down our guard for this period, because Omicron has now been proven to not cause the same amount of serious illness as previous variants, and that it's manageable. We absolutely can still catch it despite being vaccinated. You know, the risk is 70 or 80% that we can still catch and transmit, but that's okay and tolerable because we have space for those who are unlucky enough to be that 1% who have to go to hospital with Omicron. That compared to that with Delta, which was more like 10%, and the original wild strain with no vaccine was more like 20%. So all of that has allowed us to change our risk tolerance. And I think you've seen that evolution of risk tolerance. What's worrying is that we definitely need to message carefully that at the moment, because of the current risks of this particular variant, we can allow this and this and this to occur. So we should actually allow people a break and gradually decrease the public health measures according to this lower risk rating. But then carefully message everybody that if a new variant comes, or when a new variant comes, because it will just be a matter of time before new variants arrive, then we may have to reintroduce some of these risk controls again. So I have no problem with going up and down. If you try and hold very, very high level controls when the risk has dropped, then people get very jaded very quickly.
Yeah.
And actually you undermine all the good you could do.
Yeah. But then how hard will it be to get people to fall back into that taking responsibility? You know, if lockdowns are reintroduced, if mask wearing is mandated, check-ins mandated, if there's a more potent variant, would that be difficult to communicate that back to the public?
I think we have no choice, because the other alternative is we keep the controls the whole time and then people will just ignore them anyway.
Sure.
So I think all we can do is look at the evidence, present that evidence to sensible people across the community and say, Listen, this we've had a good break. We've done some good controls of Omicron. Omicron's now flattened out and become less of a problem. But this new variant shows us that actually the hospitalization rate used to be 1%. Now it's back up to 15-20%. Your previous vaccinations may or may not work, and therefore we need to do X, Y, and Z, whatever controls are. So I think the same, we should also be very clear, the same pillars that used to work still work: physical distancing, masks, hand hygiene, and environmental cleaning and disinfection all still work for this variant, just like the other ones. I think the next step really will be, do we need to continue with new boosters, and just encourage that to be the case rather than keep on going back to lockdown. So I'm not positive towards lockdown. I think lockdown is the bluntest instrument possible. It affects mostly the poor or low income wage earners who have to usually turn up to work. Those of us privileged enough to work from home, honestly, actually probably have some savings and can manage that, whereas the poor parts of society don't do very well in lockdown. And I don't think that's been well messaged enough. And we should not go to lockdown until we absolutely have to. If it's going to be a lockdown, it's got to be a very small, discrete one, not this entire statewide. It's a huge blunt instrument and seems to be seized by politicians for other sort of reasons. You should see what a lockdown does in a poor income setting, in other countries. We saw these occur in Sierra Leone during Ebola. I certainly saw some of this occur in the Pacific, and some of them are actually occurring even now. And when you're in a country where there isn't a lot of fridges, where people must get fresh food each day to live, you've got to have another alternative. And eventually we were having to distribute food to households so that would encourage them to stay in isolation in Sierra Leone, in Freetown, the capital, because any other option wasn't an option really, because people had to leave home to go to the market to get fresh food because there was no refrigeration and no other way to live.
Yeah, true. I mean, you can live a very blinkered life when you live in Australia compared to how something like that impacts, you know what you were just talking about. You recently spoke to Noosa Council. Can you tell me about what that presentation entailed and what kind of work you're doing with local government?
Yeah, so this was at the height of our outbreaks here on the Sunshine Coast, when a lot of businesses were being impacted. A lot of staff were infected at once. Quite a time of uncertainty. Omicron was starting to really escalate, and there was a complete lack of particularly rapid antigen tests, which was a tool that was sort of just rolled out without any of the planning on how it might be reported. Whether we would have caches and supplies of these left behind. None of that was done, as I talked about earlier on. So luckily we actually did have some. We had some ready for some of the businesses that we were supporting elsewhere across the country, and we brought in some extra stock. And working with Noosa Council, we had an agreement to reinvigorate some of the messaging on how to prevent Omicron, the signs to watch out for. So we put together some posters that went out to businesses and out to the community to message better. And then we triaged requests. So it was a lot of panicked small business owners who had no other way to manage their business, but also help their staff get access to tests. So we would get calls and emails, and we had a special sort of hotline and an order system. And then quietly we were then selling small amounts of tests to those business owners, so they could take them, distribute them to their staff and to the families of those staff, so that they could get through their little outbreaks at the home setting, and then be able to get back to work and keep everybody safer while we had such an amount of tourists in town. And effectively, this was a we also then ran several webinars for business leaders and for we prioritized very early on all the NGOs and those who were dealing with the vulnerable in our community, and also to help the council with critical services, for example, bin collection. So it's incredible how, if we can't manage the workers and support the workers who are doing those really important things for our local community, then they end up not being able to get to work because of the strict rules around isolation after contact. And we would all have had some issues with rubbish on our streets and all sorts of other social impacts.
Yeah, we've all experienced from time to time family members, grandparents that have ended up in aged care or nursing homes. Can I get your opinion and your thoughts on what's currently happening in aged care here in Australia in terms of the number of cases and deaths that we're experiencing in aged care, and what could be done or can be done differently?
Yeah, it is tragic. Of course, we always knew that COVID was going to affect the more vulnerable in our society, so aged or older people, especially if they have comorbidities, other illnesses, heavily pregnant women, it certainly affects them, and then sometimes young children as well, depending on their pre-existing medical conditions. So that's the case for flu pandemics each year when they come through, and it has been the case for COVID over these last 2 years. When we learnt down in Victoria during that response in August, September of 2020, some of the things that were occurring, for example, coming in at a public health level and telling everybody who was working there to leave because they were a contact, and leaving nobody behind who had any knowledge of the residents in the home, who liked what kind of food, how they best are able to communicate with them, what medications they're on. If you take all of those dedicated aged care workers out of a facility all at once, then very, very dangerous things happen to those residents. There's lots more falls, lots more confusion in people who perhaps are more confused prior from dementia and other things. It's really heartbreaking. And that's what we saw back in the aged care outbreaks of August, September 2020. And one of the reasons why I was trying to advocate for rapid antigen testing for staff and contractors and visitors at aged care, because that's the best way to keep it off site for as long as possible. So we've been actually working with the federal government since late last year to roll that out in the cities most affected, particularly Sydney and Melbourne, when they had their Delta outbreaks. We certainly are still helping the federal government roll that out in mass scale. We don't supply, where that's brought through by the government itself. We provide the training to the workers on site and the managers on site so they can safely roll that out. Now, there's a couple of other issues that are occurring right now in aged care that I think we should all look at carefully. And one is the booster shots, because we're still seeing the vast majority of deaths and serious illness occurring in older people. And they deserve to get access to boosters as early as possible. And I want to really examine whether that booster rollout is occurring at the speed that we're told it is. I'm not so sure. Certainly my anecdotal experience in aged care has been that not everybody has been offered the booster, and there's been some delays. And I know that's not the message perhaps we're getting from central government, but we do need to examine that and make sure it's really occurring and push it as hard as we possibly can, because everybody deserves that third booster, especially if you're older and more vulnerable.
Yeah.
And it hasn't occurred yet. And secondly, having good ways to support the management on site so an outbreak can be extinguished as fast as possible. And that sort of management of the right resources, sending in the right personal protective equipment immediately, there's a single case, so we can nip it in the bud and not have it spread. That requires a lot of coordination. That's sort of what we were, as I say, doing in Victoria, but that was a big emergency operations center just to manage this. And I haven't seen that scale up across the country now that we have over 2,000 aged care facilities infected now. I don't see a centralized control and coordinated approach to that. And that's, I think we could do better there too.
What's up on the work in progress whiteboard there at Respond Global, Ian?
Well, some really exciting things going on. We certainly have still a lot of COVID work domestically here with business and with government. We're supporting a lot over in New Zealand, actually, and they're facing their big waves of Omicron. We're supporting some businesses and organizations who work out of West Australia, and they're facing theirs as well. Got some exciting work in the pipeline coming in from WHO to help their preparedness and the ability for their country offices in places like the Middle East to respond faster and better to outbreaks and conflicts and disasters post COVID. And then for COVID, I suppose the biggest thing we're doing right now is we're finalizing the preparation of a big ship, it's modest size, about 100 feet. It's an old cruise ship that we've taken ownership of. We're rejuvenating it, making sure it's seaworthy. Putting in some extra vaccine storage rooms, treatment centers, and other things, so making it more of a medical ship. And she'll depart for Vanuatu in the next couple of weeks. And we're going to support the Vanuatu government to to finish its COVID vaccine rollout because it's still a closed country. It's got a coverage rate about 45% double dose, maybe about 70% single dose. So it's got a little bit of way to go before it can open safely, a bit like Fiji has already. And it relies so heavily on tourism and visitors to, it needs to reopen so it can start that economic flow again. But we're gonna help vaccinate the outer islands. And we only took this on because we were promised that we can work directly with the Vanuatu medical teams themselves. I helped set some of those up and support their government to set up medical response teams in my previous role. So now we're gonna go back in and work with that medical response team, and they'll jump aboard with us and it'll be a joint venture. So it'll be Vanuatu's vaccinating Vanuatuans, and we're about 18 or 20 of our team supporting them.
News also, now international borders are being lifted. Before I let you go, any thoughts, opinion, strategies, things we should be doing different before we get an influx of international tourists and visitors back into the country?
Well, I think it's all about confidence, and to be frank, they're all watching us actually, and thinking that they're going to come here and catch COVID. They're not, so we're worried about them, and they're more worried about us. So I think doing the right thing with all those pillars I talked about before, the hand hygiene and physical distancing and things, they all still work. I think our risk coming up will be in the southern states, that in winter may well bring a bit of a peak again of COVID. And for the Sunshine Coast, that means visitors coming from down south, where they're having their winter, that could introduce a more infection. But I think it's all manageable. And we should all be able to get on with sort of business continuity plans, things that allow us to continue to work even when COVID is circulating. This is what we really should be aiming for properly. I don't have a real concern at the moment with new variants, but I think we need to all be vigilant that new variants could emerge. And unfortunately, it's going to emerge from countries that haven't had access to vaccines yet, because the more circulating virus in a population, the more chance that some virus somewhere will create a little mutation that gives it an advantage, and that will kick off into a new variant. I do hope we all continue to support a global rollout of vaccine, not just looking at our own backyard and being boosted ourselves, but making sure there's enough funding flowing into low income settings so that they can be vaccinated. It's the only way we're going to decrease the chance of new variants.
Dr. Ian Norton, a founder and managing director of Respond Global, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. Dr. Ian Norton from Respond Global, he was my guest on today's episode of Everyone Has a Story. If you enjoyed listening to today's episode, please share it about on your social media networks. Tell your friends and family about it. And if you're listening via Apple Podcasts or Wooshka or Stitcher, rate and review today's episode and the podcast overall. Until next time, take care.